This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, teams of United Nations experts gathered testimony on human rights violations against Black people in the United States. A People's Tribunal finds the governor of Michigan and the mayor of Detroit guilty of crimes against humanity. And the Haitian people say a resounding no to rigged elections and rule by foreigners.
But first, the U.S. Supreme Court has given hope to thousands of prison inmates who were sentenced to life without possibility of parole for crimes committed when they were juveniles. The High Court ruled that such sentences are unconstitutionally cruel and unusual punishment. One of those who might win release from prison is Carrie Shakabuno Marshall, a Pennsylvania inmate who was sentenced to life more than 25 years ago at age 17. Marshall is a contributor to Prison Radio and editor of a magazine. He was interviewed by Prison Radio's Noel Henrihan.
I get a chance to return to society as well and show people that I'm not the animal that they was portraying me to be, not the criminal that they was portraying me to be, and that I am a productive person in society and a good person as well.
What's it going to mean to your mom?
One of the things that she always wanted was to see me once again before she passed away.
It's a long way from here to there.
Pennsylvania, they really don't want to carry out the spirit of the Miller decision. They want child lifers to die in prison.
That was Carrie Shakabuno Marshall serving a life term in Pennsylvania.
Teams of experts from the United Nations held hearings last week on human rights violations against Black people in the United States. Testimony was heard in Jackson, Mississippi, Baltimore, Chicago, and New York City. Afia Wangaza, a people's lawyer and director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina, has been taking Black grievances to the United Nations for years. We asked Wangaza what the UN human rights officials wanted to talk about.
In large measure, pretty much anything that we want to talk about, because the goal is to inform the Human Rights Council of the status and quality of life or lack of quality of life of Black people in the United States. And it will provide a baseline for reference over the decade for people of African descent and treaty reviews of the United States and its failure to comply with its obligations under the four treaties to which it is a party.
And you've made a presentation before the United Nations on behalf of the Malcolm X Center.
Well, it was Malcolm X Center led, but we had a number of issues raised. One is police terror in the schools, which was represented by testimony by Naya Kenny, one of the co-defendants in the Spring Valley 2 case, where this 300-pound white male in-school cop slung a 98-pound 16-year-old girl across the room for refusing to give up her cell phone or to allow herself to be denied the benefit of the day's lecture in her math class. There was testimony in our delegation presented by former political prisoner Sekou Kambui, who spoke generally to the matter of political prisoners, but more specifically to medical neglect as torture and as aimed at behavior modification of political prisoners. His testimony was quite stark and startling as he sat there as a cancer victim, currently in the throes and treatment of colon cancer, who have been sentenced to life in Alabama's prisons for crimes that he did not commit, and released only once they determined after misdiagnosis that he had colon cancer, and was released to avoid the continuing legal liability and the expenses of treating him. Now, the state, of course, will have to treat him, but it won't come out of the prison budget. So the issue of political prisoners, and of course, we raise the cases of others who are the victims of medical neglect throughout the country, including that of Imam Jamil Al-Amin and Lumia Abu-Jamal in the lawsuit that he has brought his own and the behalf of others. And to our great surprise and pleasure, we found that the chair of the committee is Frantz Fanon's daughter, and that they are submitting, the committee is submitting, a brief in support of the litigation that Lumia has brought on his and others' behalf. There was testimony around the question of self-determination and the fact that we as a people have never been allowed to launch a plebiscite on our own behalf and to make a decision whether or not we wanted to be Americans, as opposed to simply having it imposed upon us by the U.S. government for its own purposes. The demand for reparations reverberated throughout most of the testimonies that were given. The question of housing, health care, Professor Vernalia Randall's extensive report on the health consequences of African people was submitted as a part of the statement on the denial of self-determination here in the United States. Financial matters were raised, the victimization of the African community with the most recent foreclosure scheme to the excessive interest rates that for payday loans. There was testimony from several attorneys and a former judge who testified to the human rights violations of the legal system. Most specifically, they focused on Mississippi, but we found that in one set of testimonies, which was presented by the director of the MacArthur Clinic at University of Mississippi Law School, that the so-called debtors' prisons practices are widely prevalent in Mississippi, as was reported in Ferguson. And as with Ferguson, is reconfirmed that we as African people, are still the economic bottom for this country. It is with these misdemeanors and traffic fines that blossom into life-changing economic burdens that the governments in the United States are financed, certainly on the local and state levels across the board. It's still slavery. It's still peonage. The only difference is that we're allowed to go home at night.
Clearly, there's lots of information available about violations of the human rights of black people here in the United States, but I'm still not clear as to the United Nations process. What is to be done with this information, and for what purpose?
We're in the second year of the decade for people of African descent. So it forms the baseline for the evaluation of the quality or lack of quality of life of black people in the broadest sense in the United States. The information gathered from the five cities from civil society will, of course, be compared with the mythology that the United States produces on a regular basis in treaty review sessions. And it will be another opportunity for civil society to say not only is the United States not the gold standard for human rights, but that at the same time that a war of genocide is being actually waged against African people in this country, inclusive of but far beyond just shooting us down in the streets, are other mechanisms that work to our destruction and our demise. Once the report is completed, it is submitted to the Human Rights Council, and it is weighed against the U.S. obligations under the U.S. governing documents of the United Nations and the treaties to which the United States is a party. That's the Universal Periodic Review, the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, and for the Convention Against Torture, Cruel and Degrading Treatment or Punishment. And just by the names themselves, you know and can readily, off the top of your head, think of violations that the United States is engaged in, from simple access to education to access to the ballot.
As you mentioned, the United Nations has designated a decade for people of African descent. That's 10 years. How long is this process that you've just been engaged in expected to take?
In the United States, the report should be, as it relates to the United States, the report is scheduled to come out in September. The investigation is not limited to the United States. It's a global investigation that will occur. So there will be fact-finding in other parts of the world so that the quality or lack of quality of life of African people will be assessed across the planet. And then the various governments will be called upon to come into compliance with their treaty obligations. And as I might add, providing us, the universal us, an other weapon to hold the various governments accountable, to educate ourselves on human rights as opposed to civil rights, raising the standard of expectation, of entitlement, and of our demand. I know that there is, in some quarters, varying degrees of cynicism given the fact that the United Nations does not have its own army and that the United States has a history of subbing the United Nations. But at the same time, the United States has a history of being concerned about its branding, concerned about how it appears to various quarters of the world for its own purposes, most recent example being, of course, Obama's refusal to approve the XL pipeline so that he could then go to Paris and present himself as an environmentalist. So we can look at that and other instances in the history of the United States where it has taken into account the international opinion and taken steps to preserve the myth of it being the gold standard for human rights and its forward-looking view in the interest of humanity, which of course we all know is untrue. And indeed, so do members of the United Nations. So we kind of creep along and get what we can, where we can, and attempt to use what we get to maximum benefit.
Yes, based upon your years of involvement in international campaigns, what would be your expectation of an outcome from this process?
I think that the report will bring together all of the various complaints that have been raised about the United States and its failure to meet its treaty obligations, certainly as they've been raised over the past 5 years, and put them all in one place to which ready reference can be made, not only by us, but by other members, member states, and other member non-governmental organizations that challenge the failure of governments to perform. I think that China, which does its own annual human rights report, will find it very useful. I think that Iran can ultimately find it useful in terms of the demands that continue to be raised against it, despite the recent agreement that it entered into. I think that it can also be used by other countries, African countries in particular, to make specific demands against the United States and United States corporations for the violations that have been made against those countries. And the United States' failure to rein in its corporations and to hold U.S. corporations responsible for misconduct beyond its borders, while they at the same time enjoy the comfort and security of the United States government and, more importantly, the United States military. I don't think that we have seen the full extent to which the report by the working group will be of use to us once presented to the Human Rights Council.
It sounds like we're talking about building up the dossier on the culprit, the U.S.
Precisely, precisely. I think that that's important. People have a tendency to be somewhat unimpressed by that, but diplomacy is war by other means, and that's what this process is.
Ifeo Wangaza in Greenville, South Carolina.
A people's tribunal has convicted Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, and two state-appointed emergency financial managers of crimes against humanity. The officials were charged with poisoning Flint's water supply and cutting off water to tens of thousands of poor people in Detroit, among other crimes. What you will hear is a juror, Claire McClinton, rendering the guilty verdict. The judge, Reverend Bill Wiley Kellerman, whose church served as the courthouse, handing down the sentence against the official wrongdoers, and Monica Lewis Patrick, a co-founder of We the People of Detroit, on how to follow up on the convictions. First, Mrs. McClinton.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to serve on this jury. We as a people will render a guilty verdict. These policies are crimes against humanity, not just Flint. My mentor that passed away, General Baker, said in one of his speeches, he noted that because of this atrocious law, that the people only have two ways to fight. In the courts, our legislation is decimated. We only got two places left, the court and the streets. And trust me, when they poison the city of Flint, they poison the wrong ones.
The unanimous guilty verdict. Mr. Michael Duggan, Mr. Richard Snyder, you are guilty of these named crimes, found so by the People's Tribunal. As the sentencing, these are serious, serious crimes. Violations of democracy and the human right to life itself. All charges which may yet be brought in conventional courts. I've considered the various penalties which the state itself is able to sanction and enforce. Imprisonment, being denied the necessities of life, being slowly poisoned with heavy metals and bacteria, or being forcibly expelled from the region, the entire region, by foreclosure, by water shut off, and the other means of the power of the state. These are not in my power. I take them under advisement and acknowledge that the judgment of this court does not preclude formal federal charges and state charges against the two of you. Mr. Snyder, Mr. Duggan, Mr. Early, Mr. Orr, you are hereby stripped of your authority to lead or rule the people of Detroit and Michigan.
Yeah!
I no longer bound to honor you in office. You are to be led in an ignominious public spectacle of your failures, your violations before the people of Michigan, the people of the nation, and the people of the world. Go. You are no longer over us.
So in terms of a tactic, there are 11 bills that are going to be moving forward. We need everybody in this room to become very familiar with the content in each one of those bills. We need you to become a voice and a champion of those bills. We need interpreters to take those bills and translate them into all the various languages that are reflected across the state of Michigan. Because what will happen if we wait on political leadership? And let's be clear about this, and I'm going to give y'all a disclaimer. Nobody's saying this but me. When you look at the Detroit and Flint situation, it was not just the GOP, though. You had black leadership. You had black clergy. You had city council people. You had mayors all across this great state that participated in this structural violence, and fully are prepared to commit genocide on the people of this state.
To want to talk about social media, but we need those of you that are writers and journalists to participate in pushing back. Go onto the pages of the Free Press and the news. Tell what you know. Those that are videographers and reporters, you record your own stories. Because right now the story is hot, but when it wasn't hot, I can tell you what was happening. The people of Flint and the people of Detroit recorded their own stories and prepared their own message and put out the own alarm to make sure that people knew that we are still here and we have a right to be. We have a right to be. If you are not aware of what's going on and what's going on the front line, there are websites that you can tap into. Detroit is Risk-Resisting Emergency Management. D-REM.org. You can go to Water You Fighting For. You can go to Flint Democracy Defense League. You can go to the People's Water Board. You can go to the Michigan Welfare Rights site. You can go to We the People of Detroit. But you must take full responsibility to deputize yourself and get in this fight. The Honorable Coleman Alexander Young said this: if you fight the good fight, you win. Well, this is it. This is it. You fight the fight and fight back. Who won?
I won.
Who won?
are the sounds of the People's Tribunal on water in Detroit.
Noted black public intellectual Adolph Reed, a political scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, is supporting Bernie Sanders for the Democratic presidential nomination, and he's not too happy about writer Ta-Nehisi Coates' recent criticism of Sanders for opposing reparations for black Americans. Dr. Reed recently appeared on Doug Henwood's WBAI radio program in New York.
Well, I read the thing in The Atlantic, and I mean, Doug, it's so utterly empty and beside the point. I can't even characterize it, right? I mean, I go back to the same thing over and over again. You can go down the Sanders platform, issue by issue, and ask, so how is this not a black issue, right? I mean, how is a $15 minimum wage not a black issue? How is public works employment, massive public works employment programs, you know, not a black issue, right? I mean, how is free college higher education, free public higher education not a black issue? And on down the line, right, the criminal justice stuff, the rest of it. So one head-scratching aspect of this is, what do people like Coates imagine is to be gained by calling the program or calling the redistribution racial and calling it reparations? And I don't understand that. I mean, in a way, it's the charitable or maybe just benign interpretation of what he and others imagine the power of this rhetoric to be, is that there's something cathartic about it, like black power. So I'm thinking, for instance, of the, you know, say Black Lives Matter, say Sandra Bland's name, move. And it's similarly, like the demand to call it reparations doesn't seem to me to make any sense whatsoever. It doesn't add anything to a call for redistribution. In fact, if anything, it could undercut demands for redistribution because there's nothing more solidaristic than demanding like a designer program that will redistribute only to one's own group and claim that group, and by the way, whether the constituency is properly understood to be a group or a population category that the speaker wants to claim to speak for as a group. But the premise that, or the demand for a redistribution that's targeted to one group, especially at a time when times are getting tougher and economic insecurity is deepening, like for everybody, just seems like it's guaranteed not to get off the ground, and it seems almost like a police action.
I'm not Ta-Nehisi Coates, but I imagine he and people who call for reparations would respond by saying that that it's meant to address wounds that were specifically racial in their origin, starting with slavery, carrying on through Jim Crow, redlining, the structure today of the criminal justice system. These are all highly racialized injuries, and only a highly racialized remedy would be appropriate to cure it. What do you say?
Well, I think the logic fails on its own terms. I mean, my question is, you know, look, you can grant, even for the sake of argument, that the injuries were in their origin highly and explicitly racialized. It does not necessarily follow from that the remedy has to be in the same coin. And I've not seen Coates, well, I haven't seen an argument from Coates about anything really, but I've not seen Coates or others who make that assertion actually argue for it, right? Give a concrete and pragmatic explanation of how that works, right? I mean, that is to say, what the response to atonement, I suppose, for past harms would look like, and what they imagine. Yeah, you can tell I'm flustered. I mean, what they imagine the response would actually be, right? Because it goes from, I mean, one thing about Coates is that he kind of makes this stuff up as he goes along, right? I mean, he's, by his own account, right, he read Baldwin and got blown away and wanted to write like Baldwin, and his editor even would check him and say, look, you're writing these passages that don't mean anything whatsoever, because he's just so focused on wanting to write like Baldwin, absent having anything in particular to say. I've never gotten what seems like a cogent explanation about how this is supposed to work, right? About how the first question for me has always been, how can you imagine putting together a political alliance that would be capable of prevailing on this issue? And what you get is a lot of what black people deserve because of the harms that have been done. I just think it's fundamentally unserious politically, but I'll say this, and I'll say this as a Sanders supporter. I'll come clean on that. But the idea that Bernie Sanders becomes the target of race-line activists now and not Hillary Clinton, and you might say, is just beyond me, and it smells, right? Like it smells to high heaven. And yeah, you might say that, well, she's not the one who pushed through NAFTA or signed the Omnibus Crime Bill or signed that other one or ended the federal government's commitment to direct provision of income support and housing for the indigent that her husband did. But she supported all that stuff then. I just don't understand. My mind is absolutely blown about the understanding of politics that undergirds this perspective that people like Coates and TFA, proud TFA alum, DeRay McKesson and Holy Roller, the Marissa Johnson and all those others embrace. I mean, it's fundamentally anti-left. And, you know, the only thing you can say is that this is a class program, right? Right. This is a program that expresses and connects with the interests or the worldview, if not interests, but they do tend to come together, of an aspiring or an upwardly mobile stratum of the black and other color PMC, POC PMC, that scoffs, sneers at programs of a material redistribution, right? I mean, like when I was working in the GI movement, when people like that would come into a meeting, I'd just ask them, so which branch of military intelligence are you assigned to?
Dr. Adolf Reed on Doug Henwood's radio show, Behind the News.
Representatives of the various warring parties in Syria are gathering in Geneva, Switzerland, for what some people are wishfully calling peace talks. Black Agenda Report editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka doesn't expect much to come out of the talks.
There's a combination of public relations and panic on the part of the Western powers. I mean, it's not really a serious event when you don't have any credible elements engaged from the so-called opposition in Syria. Instead, you have these collections of so-called rebels put together by these rogue states like the Saudis. And you have the Turks, who basically said that if the Kurds are involved, they will withdraw from the whole show. So this is, I think, a replay of both Geneva 1 and 2. I think the only thing that has really changed is that the Western powers and the Gulf Cooperation Council are more concerned about the possibility that the whole strategy of regime change is now coming apart. So they are now engaged in this process to see if they can entangle the Syrian state into a protracted diplomatic process and hope that in the meantime, they can figure out a way to change the military conditions on the ground, which at this point is now becoming less favorable to them than before.
One interesting aspect is that, due, I guess, to the UN Security Council resolution that specifically names not just ISIS, but also al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate, as being terrorist organizations, the United States is having trouble separating ISIS, which it claims it is fighting, from al-Nusra, which is notably left out of much of the Western countries' rhetoric about terror in Syria.
True. And of course, that's quite obvious because everyone who is involved in this and who are honest, they know that the al-Nusra Front has been enhanced as a consequence of direct support from U.S. and NATO states. That much of the support that was going to the so-called moderate rebels ended up in the hands of al-Nusra, also in the hands of ISIS. But we know al-Nusra, we know that the al-Nusra Front was also part of the so-called Army of Conquest, which was cobbled together and was the main fighting force that the Western powers and the GCC thought was going to be the ones that would make the push into Damascus right before the Russians intervened. So everyone knows that the so-called moderates don't exist, that the rebel factions in Syria are basically dominated by the jihadist elements, with the al-Nusra Front being a central component of that. So that's part of the challenge for this, the so-called phony talks, is how do you have talks when the main military forces on the ground are excluded, and including the al-Nusra Front?
Let's talk about the impact of the Russian intervention, which is still only a couple of months old. What's been the effect militarily, diplomatically, and in terms of morale?
Well, in terms of the morale of the Syrian military, of course, it's been completely reversed. I mean, they were on the heels before the intervention occurred. Militarily, they have not been able to reclaim important territory in Syria. They have been able to militarily separate, to a certain extent, al-Nusra from ISIS. And diplomatically, the change in the conditions on the ground have given the Syrian government a little breathing space. They're no longer going to be compelled to have to either give up Assad or evacuate the capital. Now, the Assad government has been greatly enhanced, and the consequence is that whatever settlement is negotiated, the current government in Syria has to be a major part of that. Now, it's a complicated situation because the Assad government is in a very fragile, very vulnerable place. The Russians intervene, but we have to remember that the Russians have their own particular interests, and that some coming to the aid of Assad because of any kind of altruism. They have their interests, and sometimes their interests may or may not correspond with the interests of the Assad government. And that's something to watch very closely.
Well, the Assad government is really the only power that the Russians could rely on to keep their base in Syria. They can't take any wooden nickels from the United States, much less the Turks or the Saudis.
No, they can, and that's part of it. And part of it, of course, is also that if the Western powers were successful in eliminating the Assad government, then the hegemony of the U.S. and the West would be secured somewhat for quite some time. And they know that they will be completely pushed out of the equation. But in strengthening the Assad government and on the heels of the agreement between the U.S. and Iran, the whole situation has basically been altered. And the state that's on its heels now is, in fact, the U.S., because they are running the real possibility of losing significant influence in the region, because even their allied states are concerned about the shift in power. You have these countries with the Iranians and backdoor discussions with the Russians, because many people perceive that this could be the major wound to the U.S. that will push them out of the region in a very significant way. So they got to make sure that with the new dispensation of power in the Middle East, that they're not going to be left out.
You're describing a kind of imperial desperation, but one of the changes since the Russian intervention that's occurred on the ground is that the United States now openly operates special forces in Syria and now has announced that the 101st Airborne Division will be going to Iraq.
Exactly. And the issue is, where is the peace movement? Where is the anti-interventionist elements in the U.S.? We see a reinvasion of Iraq with the real possibility of those forces being redeployed or other forces deployed into Syria. So that's why these talks are basically, they have a diplomatic element, but of course the diplomatic element sometimes serves as cover while the military equation is shifted. So they pretend that they are about peace and want to engage in a peace conference, while at the same time they are deploying their forces to be able to still pursue military options. So this is a very dangerous occurrence. I mean, this whole discourse, too, in terms of boots on the ground, and even Ash Carter said a few days ago that the American people have to understand we already have boots on the ground in terms of special forces. When did boots on the ground exclude special forces? So the discourse is used to obscure the reality that basically you have U.S. forces already involved in conflict in Syria, and they're going to escalate that as long as they don't see any significant opposition from the American people. So it's a very dangerous equation because, again, it is panic. As we first started when we started the conversation, that the panic is forcing them to the table in this phony process, but is also compelling them to increase the ante in terms of their military involvement.
Meanwhile, the Obama administration and the corporate media, acting as an echo, keep saying that the Russians are not bombing ISIS, when that's been untrue from the very start.
Well, of course, and that's part of the propaganda game that's being played. But what I find really interesting, though, in terms of how the propaganda game is being played in the U.S., is how foreign policy has basically been erased from the conversation, both for the Republicans and the Democrats. Now, the Republicans, they have some people who talk about carpet bombing for a few minutes or whatever, and no one takes that seriously. But in terms of the Democrats, that last debate, the town hall meeting and the last debate, there was almost no discussion of foreign policy. And we find that across the board, it appears that among the major media outlets, that there's not a lot of conversation around this escalation of U.S. intervention in the region. It almost appears to be sort of like a conspiracy, if you will. So the only stories that can break through are those propaganda stories that talk about Russian bombing resulting in civilian deaths, or the Russians were not really bombing ISIS, but targeting the other jihadist forces, which is true. Russians are making a distinction between the ISIS, that is, and al-Nusra, because for them, they're just two sides of the same coin. The problem was, as Zygmunt Brzezinski indicated, al-Nusra and the Army of Conquest were, quote-unquote, our assets. So that's what's being played in Syria, a massive game, a dangerous game, a game in which it appears that the U.S. and their strategy are not prepared to pursue peace, but instead are prepared to up the military equation in order to try to maintain their political and even physical dominance and presence in the region.
Yes, and back to the election campaign, there seems to be no basic disagreement between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, except that Sanders keeps hearkening back to his vote against giving war powers to George Bush, which is reminiscent of the 2008 campaign, in which there was little foreign policy difference between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, except Obama kept on hearkening back to his 2002 speech against the Iraq invasion.
It's almost like the actors have switched. And then progressives and people who should know better are not raising these questions, are not calling attention to the fact that there's not much of a difference between Sanders and Hillary Clinton regarding their support for U.S. hegemony, U.S. Imperialist hegemony around the world. And even Sanders has a position that's even more strange and even immoral when he talks about the Saudis need to have some skin in the game. Well, Bernie, either he doesn't understand or he's being completely dishonest. The Saudis have plenty of skin in the game. In fact, if it wasn't for their intervention directly in supporting these extremist elements, there wouldn't be a Syrian conflict. That their money and their support, their political and diplomatic support, were the driving force that created the situation we have in Syria. So this is absolutely ridiculous. That basically, instead of a progressive stand being that the Saudis should adhere to international law, that those individuals who are Saudi citizens who are still transferring significant resources to these extremist jihadist forces should be prosecuted under U.S. law and international law. None of that's being said because the Saudis are still playing a significant role with the U.S. And we have right now international impunity to war crimes and crimes against humanity and criminal behavior on the part of states and individuals who are part of the Western alliance.
Yes, by absolving the Saudis of culpability in Syria, Bernie Sanders is in fact absolving the United States, since the United States and the Saudis have been partners in jihadist warfare for many decades.
Exactly, and perpetuating this narrative of U.S. innocence, the U.S. standing on the side, and as a consequence, then the jihadist forces enhance their power, and that the U.S. and the Saudis should play a more significant role in combating the very same forces that they helped to create. So it's a ridiculous position, but it's the position that has traction within the U.S. media world and popular discourse. And unless these forces, these individuals are called out and exposed and their positions exposed, then these kind of ridiculous positions will continue to be taken seriously by not only the media, but by the American people.
And they're not being called out by what we used to call the peace movement because, well, many of these former peace organizations also buy into much of what Bernie Sanders is saying.
Unfortunately, that seems to be the truth. I mean, there are some peace organizations that are still, you know, fighting a good fight, but they are very, very small now. Most of the progressives and liberals have gone over to the Bernie Sanders camp, and they are silent. And it's really an immoral stance that they're taking, because in their silence, they are basically aligning themselves not only with the Democratic Party and the ruling class, but they are aligning themselves against the interests of most of humanity. And they are aligning themselves with white supremacy. And it's strange that you have so many now black folks getting on board with this when you have basically a candidate that seems to be opposed to the interests of black folks when it comes to the international arena, a place in which progressive black folks always had progressive positions. But after Obama and now with this emerging Bernie Sanders campaign, there's mass confusion sprinkled with some immorality when it comes to this issue of foreign policy and Bernie Sanders.
That was Barr editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka.
Much of the population of Haiti is celebrating the cancellation of elections that were scheduled for last week. The previous attempt at presidential elections in October was so blatantly crooked that no one but the U.S.-backed regime believed the results, and the number two candidate refused to take part in a runoff. Negotiations are now taking place on who will make up a transition government until honest elections can be held. The last time there was an honest vote in Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected president. However, Aristide and his FONMI-LAVALAS party were overthrown by a U.S.-backed coup in 2004. Pierre Labossiere of the Haiti Action Committee says the people are determined to have a say in the next government in Haiti.
There is a lot of posturing, a lot of theater that's going on. Basically, what it boils down to is the people, consistent with what was happening earlier, the people have taken to the streets and upset the very nature of this thing, that they wanted to be a nice little continuation of Martelly. And so by the people taking it over and saying, look, we are not going to sit by and watch you guys play that. We are going to be actors in this game. They have upset the cards. And one group you never hear the mass media talk about is FONMI-LAVALAS. And they've been the ones really upsetting the cards, you know. And most people, the majority of the population identifies with them. So what you are saying is the continued marginalization of the grassroots, of the majority population, simply by whoever is writing the story. And the people who are writing the story and getting it published are the moneyed people. So what upset the court has been the entry of the grassroots in there, upset it. It's been ongoing, almost daily, huge demonstrations that have been occurring. And that's why these elections have been postponed. Now, Jude Celestin was faced with two things, Jude and a number of others, but particularly him. And it's not to say that he didn't show courage by doing what he did, but he knew that the alternative was that he would be played like he got played last time, because Martelly was going to put Jovenel Moïse in there regardless. I mean, that was, and he had the okay of the U.S., France, Canada, the European Union, to put his buddy Jovenel in office. So if Jules Celestin had gone in, that would have been it. And the people wouldn't have turned out to vote for Jules. So Jules made the smart move, the right move, politically speaking. But it's not because I believe he's such a patriot.
And what does the family Lavalas want to see happen in the next weeks and months?
What family Lavalas has been doing, they've been working very closely with the mass movement in Haiti and putting forth different things, different working with the mass movement, being in the street. Now all these guys are trying to make some deals excluding the population. And family Lavalas is saying, hell no, this ain't going to happen. The population has to be included in whatever comes out of this. One, it's very clear that there has to be a transition government because Martelly's boy, Jovenel Moïse, is not going to be put in there. So that's a given. But then a real dialogue. Now, there's a lot of jockeying what form this is going to take. You have different groups that are now appearing for the very first time and saying that they are the ones who will take over the leadership or giving the solution and all of that. But again, it's to the exclusion of the mass. But for me, Lavalas is saying there's got to be a real dialogue. There's got to be an investigation into what happened. It will be something with the participation of the mass in the dialogue and not like it has always been before, the exclusion of the majority population.
And not the legislature that was elected in previous flawed or bogus elections.
Exactly, because that legislature itself is very, very flawed. And what they did was, in order to try to seat the legislature, they went through, really on the Sunday, through the back window, the back door, they made these guys go in a way, because the population was getting ready to be present in full force in front of the legislature. That Monday, I think that was a week ago. But then they had these guys come in on a Sunday without anybody knowing what was happening. So, but still, regardless of that, they still could not do what they had hoped to do. Because right now the scandal is to such a level that they are saying that they have to just because someone was admitted in the legislature doesn't mean that they won't kick them out once they find out that they were fraudulently elected. So, you know, it's that kind of game. So in other words, the entry of the masses into this whole equation, dating back to over a year ago, right? Because a lot of the stuff wasn't being put out there. People were ignoring it. People were saying, well, the masses, but I knew what was happening. Most people in Haiti knew what was happening because they were driving the stuff. And they were determined that this time it wouldn't be that way. So it's a very dynamic situation with a lot of misrepresentations, rumors, mischaracterization, a lot of posturing, a lot of attempts being made basically to exclude the population from the final decision. But the people are saying nothing doing. They are in there and they will be there.
And what about the threats by people like Guy Philippe, the armed terrorist duvalierist who says that he's about to go to war?
The whole thing reeks of the stench of conspiracy, duplicity. So now they are pulling out Guy Philippe to make Guy Philippe as a scare tactic, not to say that, you know, the guy is a murderer. He has murdered before, he's ready to murder again, as he has announced. But from what I'm hearing from the many brothers and sisters on the grassroots level, they are saying that they are not going to be intimidated by Guy Philippe. And last time, it wasn't Guy Philippe who overthrew President Aristide. It was the U.S., France, and Canada who sent their troops and carried out this operation. and the Gifili people were protected by the U.S. Marines. That's how they came into Port-au-Prince. So I saw an article where, and it's one of several, which described what happened in 2004, and basically they amplified what Guy Philippe and his guys were about to do, and they amplified it, and it was part of that theater to create the impression that they were the ones who carried it out, but everybody knows it was the U.S., France, and Canada's forces that really did that coup, that kidnapping coup.
Would you expect representatives of family Lavalas to be in the next interim government?
You know, that I don't know. It depends, because it's a very fluid, dynamic situation. The Haitian people have to have their say, and we are hearing all kinds of shenanigans going on among foreign powers who have traditionally tried to exclude the Haitian population, the majority population, from the affairs of their country. And right now, that's what they are engaged in doing. And so the people will determine that this is not going to happen, that they have a say, because they have to improve the conditions of their lives. They have to, government is there to provide for the people and work with the people and represent the people's interests. And for too long, it has represented the interests of a small minority and people who murder people and a mafia, a local mafia that's affiliated with an international mafia. And so people are not going to accept it. And so what form things will take, it will depend on the engagement of the masses in this struggle, which by the looks of it, they are fully engaged in this. So we'll see.
Are you confident that Martelly will physically vacate the presidential grounds early next month, as he promises to do?
Well, that's the Constitution. He has to leave by February 7th. And the demand of the people on the streets is that Martelly be gone, and that he should have been gone long ago. And so from there, again, it's a dynamic situation. I cannot foretell what will happen. But I'm very confident that the people are definitely mobilized to change the situation.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.